Awesome. By Paul D'Amato. Section. The myth of state socialism. The single worst legacy of Stalinism was to reinforce the mistaken notion that socialism can be measured by the degree of state control of the economy. Societies with strong social spending programs and some state-run industries were considered moderately socialist, like Sweden. I can't count how many times I've been asked, "When you say socialism, do you mean Sweden?" Societies with more complete state control of the economy, like the Stalinist Soviet Union before it fell, or Cuba today, were considered fully socialist or communist. The existence of a more or less expansive social safety net may indicate a strong history of class struggle and strong unions who at some point were able to extract important concessions from the employers. But concessions wrested from a capitalist state do not render that society socialist. Nor is the degree of state ownership a measure of socialism. State-run industries under capitalism do not operate as islands of socialism, but on the same principles of profit and loss as in the private sector. A kind of spurious socialism has arisen that declares all state ownership to be socialistic, Frederick Engels wrote more than 100 years ago. Quoted, quote, "Certainly, if the taking over by the state of the tobacco industry is socialistic, then Napoleon must be numbered among the founders of socialism." Even total state ownership, Engels argued, is not socialism. Quote, "The transformation, either into joint stock companies and trusts, or into state ownership, does not do away with the capitalistic nature of the productive forces. In the joint stock companies and trusts, this is obvious. And the modern state, again, is only the organization that bourgeois society takes on in order to support the external conditions of the capitalist mode of production, against the encroachments, as well, of the workers as of individual capitalists. The modern state, no matter what its form, is essentially a capitalist machine, the state of the capitalists, the ideal personification of the total national capital. The more it proceeds to the taking over of productive forces, the more does it actually become the national capitalist. The more citizens does it exploit. The workers remain wage workers, proletarians." End quote. Before Stalin expelled him from Russia in 1928, Trotsky waged a fight against the rising bureaucracy. But he clung to the idea that since nationalized property in Russia had been established as a result of a workers' revolution, Russia could not be state capitalist, that is, a nation where the state exercised the same control over industry as the capital countries. Nevertheless, he could still say about the nationalized industries in Mexico in the 1930s that, quote, "The nationalization of railways and oil fields in Mexico has, of course, nothing in common with socialism. It is a measure of state capitalism." End quote. Trotsky noted that in Mexico, union leaders were involved in the management of these state-run industries. This had nothing to do with workers' control. The union leaders were expected to play the role of disciplining the working class, making it more industrious in the service of the common interests of the state, which appears on the surface to merge with the interests of the working class itself. This is certainly the role unions played in Stalin's Russia. In 1980, a workers' newspaper, Jednosc, published by Solidarnosc activists in Chechen, Poland, made the same point, arguing that a distinction must be made between state ownership and social ownership, because the Polish state apparatus represented the denial and negation of the world of labor. With state ownership of production, the capitalist relation is not done away with, wrote Engels. It is rather brought to a head. Countries where most of the means of production are concentrated in the hands of a state bureaucracy, but where workers have no control over that production, have nothing to do with socialism. Workers' revolts in Eastern Europe, including the forming of workers' councils in Hungary in 1956, similar to the 1917 Soviets, were the practical proof that these societies were socialist in name only. The Cuban Revolution overthrew a corrupt regime, stood up to the Colossus to the north, and implemented a series of sweeping social reforms benefiting Cuba's poor, making it one of the most remarkable revolutions in the Western Hemisphere. But Cuba's workers played hardly any role at all in its victory, nor did they exercise any control over the state in its aftermath. Fidel Castro, Ernesto Che Guevara, and a relatively small group of several hundred guerrillas toppled the regime of Fulgencio Batista in 1959. Facing an American embargo, they began to nationalize U.S.-owned property. Castro only retroactively declared the Cuban Revolution socialist, some 2 years later, modeling Cuba's one-party state, based on Fidel's personal rule, on Russian-style state capitalist-led development. Supporters of Cuba, that is, people who support the regime itself rather than its defense against the United States, claim that various reforms such as improved healthcare, better education, and so on, are indications of Cuba's socialist character. These were no doubt important gains of the revolution. But then again, a number of important democratic and social gains issued also from the French Revolution, and it was not socialist. If free secondary education and national healthcare are to be deemed socialist, then Canada must be included also on the list. The claim is also made that the Cuban government is controlled from below by the people. But this is to confuse mass participation and popularity with democratic decision-making and control. Popular organizations in Cuba are transmission belts for directives from the top, rather than institutions of control from below. Bureaucratic planning is geared towards figuring out how to develop and diversify the Cuban economy, of which labor is merely another input that is exploited in the same way workers are exploited in a GM factory in Detroit. Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, described the role in unions of reunions in Cuba in the 1970s as something akin to the role of managers in a capitalist enterprise. Quote, "One of the principal functions of the trade unions under socialism is to serve as a vehicle for the orientation, directives, and goals which the revolutionary power must convey to the working masses. The principal tasks in which the unions should be involved are productivity and work discipline, and more efficient utilization of the workday." End quote. Minister of Labor, Georges Risquet, was careful that same year to inform Cuba's workers that, quote, "The fact that Fidel and I have suggested that the workers should be consulted does not mean we are going to negate the vanguard role that the party must play. The decision and responsibility in the enterprise," he insisted, "fall to the management, which must have, and does have, all the authority to act." End quote. The same holds true for planning. A socialist society seeks to end the anarchy of the market by introducing conscious planning. But planning alone doesn't equal socialism. There are already elements of planning under capitalism. There is planning within firms, within the Pentagon, in the post office, and so on. But none of these forms of planning eliminate the anarchy of the market. Instead, they are driven by it. There is state planning in Cuba, but the plan is shaped by Cuba's survival and the negotiation of its precarious position within the world economy, of which it is a small, isolated patch. The planning isn't democratic, or fully under the planner's control. In all of these examples, the planning is designed to maximize output and profit at the expense of the worker, not to meet human need. Imagine the tremendous organization and planning involved in executing a major US-led war, and you get some idea of what might be possible if all that energy were used to adequately feed, house, clothe, and educate everyone on the planet. The question of nationalization is not unimportant. As, for example, when Bolivian workers and peasants demand that the country's natural gas industry be nationalized in order that the wealth it yields doesn't end up being siphoned off by global capital. But so long as nationalization is based upon production and competition in a world market, it will be capitalist nationalization. For Marxists, nationalization can only be a weapon in the transformation of society in a social direction if the working class has first placed itself in power. Is it doing the planning, or is it being planned? The question of whether socialism exists, therefore, does not depend on this or that form of property, private ownership, or nationalization, but on whether the society is in the hands of the associated producers, the working class. In fact, the aim of workers' power is to implement a series of economic and social transformations that do away with all class distinctions, and create a society whereby the state, an instrument of class domination, gradually fades away. As Engels wrote, "The proletariat seizes the power, and by means of this transforms the socialized means of production, slipping from the hands of the bourgeoisie into public property." End quote. The economy, now under workers' control, socializes the means of production so that production and distribution can be carried out according to a rational plan that meets human needs. In proportion as anarchy in social production vanishes, Engels continued, "the political authority of the state dies out." End quote. To be successful, this process requires that socialism be international. All talk of there being long-standing islands of socialism, socialist states, floating for years on a sea of capitalist competition, is simply an absurdity. Socialism in one cooperative, in one city, one island, or one country is a contradiction in terms. End of section.